All right, welcome to networking. I'm going to follow Kelly's example and do the seminar seated. So it's a little bit weird, but try it anyway. All right, so the library that I'm going to be telling you about is called the Berkeley Sockets Library, which has pretty much become the de facto standard for programming networks. It's available on all platforms and pretty much every program that uses internet networking is using this library. So this is how you do it. The fundamental concept in the Berkeley Sockets Library is this thing called a socket. And a socket is really just a connection between two hosts. And a host is a computer or a program running on a computer. So here's an example where I have a socket, and on one side I have host one that has an IP address and some port that the socket is attached to. And on the other side is some other host with some different IP address and some other port. So on the internet networking, the ends of sockets are addressed by this IP number and port number. So I'm assuming you're familiar with IP addresses and ports. I think maybe you even talked about them in lecture. Is that right? Yeah? Okay. So this is a picture of a socket that's both bound and connected. So this terminology is used throughout the library and actually among networking people, a bound and connected socket. Bound means that it's connected to me on my end. That's what the term bound means. And connected means that it's connected to someone on the other end. So if I'm host one, this socket is bound to me on port 3472, and it's connected to this other guy on this other port. If I happen to be host two, then it's bound to me on port 7958, and it's connected to the guy over on host one on some other port. Okay? So you'll see that kind of terminology. You can also have a socket that's not connected, that's just bound, and it's still useful. You can still use a socket that's in this state. You can send packets to other people. It just turns out that some protocols require the socket to be connected and some don't. You can also have a socket which is not bound, not connected, and this particular socket is not really useful. But you do encounter them when you're programming in the library because as you start things up, your sockets start out in this state. Okay. Right, so I'm going to show you a bunch of programs that will tell you how to create sockets, how to send and receive messages, using a little library that I wrote last night, which I'm calling CS50 Socket. And using this library, we'll also write a simple web browser, which I'll show you how that works. And then I'm going to show you how the functions in the library actually work by showing you all the code in the library. And there's about 100 lines or so it's not very complicated. And then after we've gone through all of that, I'm going to tell you how you actually write a network program, which is going to have something to do with event-driven programming and a little function called select. So let's just get right to it. We're actually going to be talking about two different kinds of sockets, or two different kinds of protocols, a datagram protocol, in particular UDP, and a stream protocol, TCP. And datagram protocol allows you to send packets which, without making any connection. So this is the case where you have a socket that's bound but not connected. And the messages are typically small, and the protocol doesn't give you any sort of guarantees that the message you sent is going to arrive, or that if you send 10 messages that they arrive in the same order that you sent them. But you can use the same socket to communicate with lots of people, and you don't have to worry about connecting to anyone. The other protocol, which is probably more common, is a connection-based protocol called TCP we're going to look at. And this one gives you reliability guarantees. All the packets you send are sequenced. If a packet for some reason doesn't arrive, it will be resent. The person on the other end is sending you acknowledgments to tell you that they have the things that you've tried to send them. And because of that, conceptually, the messages you can send are arbitrarily large because the protocol will automatically break them up, deliver them all, and reassemble them on the other side. But the price you pay for all of this is that TCP is a little bit more chatty. There's a little bit more traffic going on. And you can only use a TCP stream connected socket with one person. So if you want to talk to two people, you need two sockets. It's not really a big price to pay, but you'll see that in the code we're going to look at. Okay, so how do you create a socket? So I've made a function called makeSocket, which will create a socket attached, or rather bound, to a particular port with a particular socket family. So we're only looking at two socket families, the DGRAM family and the stream family. And I've tried to, throughout this talk, color things in blue, which are in the CS50 socket library that I wrote. So later on, we're going to be looking at the implementation of make socket. So that's what the blue indicates. But for now, the way you use this is if you say call make socket, this first call, 3031 sock DGRAM, it gives you a bound socket that can send datagram packets. And the port that is bound to on your side is 3031. You can also create a stream socket, like in the second example, and this is a bound stream socket, so it will have to be connected in order to use it, whereas the datagram socket does not. And this third example is showing you that you can also provide a port number 0, which just means give me whatever port number is available. I don't really care what it is. So in this case, this last one would probably be given some random port number like, I don't know, 7050 or something. Okay? So before we go much farther, I'm going to have to tell you a little bit about how socket addresses are represented in the library itself. So there are actually lots of different kinds of socket addresses. The socket library can program not just internet protocols, but other kinds of protocols, Unix domain sockets and Xerox PARC networking protocol. And a lot of these things aren't used anymore, but the library still supports them. So for internet sockets, the way that they're represented is with this struct called socket address in. The IN stands for internet. And what's, so for instance, you know, if you're trying to go to Google's website, it might have an IP address of that. And we know that the web server is running on port 80. So if we want to connect to this service, this web service, then we have to build one of these structs and we have to fill up a bunch of fields. The most important fields, or perhaps the only important fields for what we're doing, are these two things, which are the port number and the address, the 64.233. And they're in these fields like so. So the question is, how do I get from, say, a string like google.com and a number like 80 to one of these things? We've got this import T, which we don't know what it is, and we have this other struct in adder, which we don't know what it is. So for now, I'm not going to tell you exactly how you do that. But I am going to tell you that there's a function which I wrote called makeAdder, where you give it a string and a port number, and it gives you back one of these structs. And later on, we'll look at exactly how that works. But for now, you would just write some code like this. You declare one of these structs. Say you call the struct Google, and then you call makeAdder with google.com 80 and a pointer to that struct, and it will fill up the struct with the right information. So this function is actually doing two things. One is it's converting that string into a number using the domain name service. And then it's also constructing this structure and making sure that everything is formatted properly. Make sense? Good. All right. So first, let's look at UDP. So I've also given you two functions called UDP send and UDP receive, which given a socket and one of these addresses, you can either receive a packet or send a packet. And here, the packet data is just going to be C strings. So the first one says, on this socket, send this message to this address, which I have in this struct called them. And the second one says, on this socket, receive a message, which it returns, And if you would like, I'll also fill up one of these structures to tell you who it was that sent you the message. All right. So let's just look at an example. So here's a complete program that can receive, rather send, a UDP packet. Okay. So first we make a socket, and this could return an error, so we check that. And then we create one of these address structures, and I ask it to be populated for my local machine, which is called localhost on port 4171. And then I just say UDP send, and I'm actually sending the contents of argv1, so it's a command line parameter, and then it prints out a message to tell me that it's sent. That's it. So that's the entire program. Okay. So it doesn't look too difficult, I hope. We can also receive packets. So here's a corresponding function called receive. It does something very similar. It creates a socket, again using port 4771, which is just arbitrary. I just picked that randomly. It creates one of these sockets and it does a receive. And then if that doesn't fail, it prints out a message telling us what we received and from who. Just to prove to you that these things work. See, I have this program that we've been looking at on the slides. This has a little bit more code in it because I'm checking the command line parameters and so forth. And I have receive, which is this one, so I can make, send, and receive. I can run receive here. Now it's just sitting there waiting for a packet to arrive, so I can run send hello cs50. And sure enough, the program that was over here on the left-hand side that was waiting for something to happen has gotten the packet, figured out that it was from this weird address 127.0.0.1, and the actual message itself. And the other program which sent the packet realized that it successfully sent 11 bytes. Okay? So we can do this again if we like. Send whatever we want. Okay. So already, just with these simple UDP sockets, you can write a network program which you can send and receive small messages. So for a lot of programs that you might like to write, this is good enough. That's all you really need. Okay? So a couple things to notice about this. One is, notice that receive is just sitting here waiting to get a packet. So hopefully your program doesn't need to do anything else except wait for a packet to arrive. Otherwise, you won't be able to do that. So later on, I'll tell you how to get around that situation. All right, so back to the exciting slides. So UDP is not necessarily appropriate in all situations. Right? The good thing about it is that it's simple, that you don't have to connect the sockets up to any peers. You just make a socket and you start sending things out to addresses and port numbers. You can also do something called send broadcast, which means you can send a message out which will be received by everyone that's on your local network, which is something you can't do with connected sockets. So if you were making a local area chat program, that might be a great thing to do because you send one packet and everyone on the network gets the packet. So you don't have to send a packet to every person. But really, it's only for small messages. And again, it can be unreliable. The messages might arrive out of order, or they might not arrive at all, and you have no way of knowing whether that's happened or not. So let's say that you wanted to make a UDP protocol reliable. How would you do it? Any ideas? Like, I send you a packet, but I don't know whether or not you got the packet. How might I go about making sure that you got the packet? Exactly. Yeah, so that's called an acknowledgement in network speak. So you have the person that received the packet send back another packet saying, I got the packet. And maybe it has some information like, it was 52 bytes, so just in case that wasn't what you sent, maybe send it again. So you might wait for a little while, and if you don't receive that acknowledgement after, say, a couple of seconds, then you send the packet again. Right? So what about packets arriving out of order? Maybe I send you 10 packets, but I want to make sure that you assemble them in the order that I sent them. How might I go about doing that? Put an ID on every packet, right? So I could number the packet. So inside of the packet itself, you could put, this is packet number one, this is packet number two. That way when I get them, I can put them in the right order. So that is essential, that is one of the things that TCP is doing for you, is it's numbering the packets and sending acknowledgments and making sure that everything is arriving and there aren't any errors. So if you need higher reliability or you need to send very large messages, then you need TCP. So far we've been working with a socket that is bound but not connected. So remember this picture that I had earlier. But now that we want the TCP protocol, the stream protocol, to keep track of this stuff for us, which packets our peer has received, we have to connect the socket to exactly one person. Okay? So we need to get to this situation. So I will give you all of this code, and we're going to look at the implementation of the library. And it's really simple. The only reason I wrote the library is because it seemed like it made the talk simpler. But you'll see that the functions like makeSocket is just 10 or 15 lines of code. But I'll give you all that code, and you're free to use it if you like it or change it. Okay, so we need to connect our socket. So first, I'm going to make a different kind of socket this time. Instead of making a SockDGram family socket, I'm going to make a stream socket because I intend to connect this one up and use TCP. So I just say that I want SockStream, and in this case I don't care which port number I get, so I put 0. Then I create a new socket address, and I ask for it to be filled up with the host name that's been given in the argv parameter and port number 80. So does anyone know what runs on port 80 typically? HTTP. Right, so we're getting ready to connect to a web server here. And now I need to, so the first part creates a socket and binds it to me, and now I want to connect that socket to this address which I put in the server struct. So I'm going to call connect. Now this, notice this function isn't blue. That's because this function is in the Berkeley Sockets API, this connect function. So I give it a socket, one of these address structures, and I have to tell it how big the address structure is. So this idiom is really common in the Sockets API, where even though I have a sock adder underscore in, the function wants a sock adder pointer, and I have to tell it how big it is. And that's because if you were programming with Unix domain sockets or Xerox PARC, you know, protocol sockets, you would have a sock adder underscore Unix or a sock adder underscore XA. And those would be different sizes, but all of them can be cast into this sock adder star, but you have to tell how big they are. Right? So often, a lot of functions will take a struct sock adder star and an integer telling you how big the struct is. So that's what we're doing with connect. We're just saying, on the socket sock, connect to the address that I'm giving you in server. And that can return an error, in which case I'm just exiting this program. Does that make sense? Where are the sockets is the question. The sockets are in your mind. The sockets are just an abstract concept. So in reality, it's just a number that represents this thing that the operating system knows about, which is a way of sending packets and receiving packets on the network. Now, in a Unix world, these sockets are actually file descriptors. So if you open a socket, if you create a socket with socket, the thing you get back is the exact same kind of thing you get back if you open a file. You can actually use them interchangeably. On Windows, that's not entirely true. But the Berkeley Sockets API is available on Windows. If you're not taking advantage of this weird file descriptor thing, then it doesn't matter. You just use it as is. Then everything would work exactly the same. So even though I'm running two programs on the same computer here, and I'm connecting to localhost port 5150 and localhost port whatever, I could just as easily run one of those programs on another computer, and instead of connecting to localhost, I would have to know the address of this machine and the address of the other machine. So this make adder function just takes a string, which is a host name like google.com, and it will figure out an address for you. So we're going to look at make adder in a few minutes, and then maybe it'll be more clear how you construct these things.
I have one more thing about sockets, which is the idea that the abstraction of these numbers, like sockets in our mind, are to make sure, since you have 20 programs on your computer that are all connecting to different, through the network to other programs, it's a way of, when the packet comes in on the network card, to figure out where to send that packet to.
Is that
like
It's not the same because a process might have a whole bunch of sockets that it's using at the same time. In fact, a web server might have one socket for every web client that it's currently talking to. All right, so this code here is creating a socket and connecting it to a remote site. So we're not quite finished. We could also send some information to that remote site. And the information I'm going to send is I'm going to take this argument number 2, and I'm going to build a string that says get slash and the name of that, the contents of that argument, and a couple of carriage returns. And then I'm going to send that using this blue function, TCP send. And then I'm going to try to receive something off of the same socket and print it out. So notice TCP send is blue, so we're going to look at the implementation of that later. But receive, that's not blue. So receive is just part of the normal API. Does anyone have any idea what this program does? It's going to grab a web page. That's right. It's actually using something called HTTP version 0.9, which is a really simple version of the HTTP protocol. So, let's try it. This is called wget.c, and just to show you, this is the code we've been looking at. It creates a socket, connects the socket, builds this string, sends the string, and then waits for a response and just prints out the response. So let's build it. And let's see. There's a web page. So we could try. So here's google.com's web page, or the first part of the web page, actually. So why did this only give me the first part of the web page? That's right. So receive takes a socket, a buffer to put the data that's received, and a size of that buffer. And I've defined size in this program to be 8K. You can see 8092 bytes. So I'm reading the first 8092 bytes of the response and exiting. So if you were writing a real web client, you might want to keep reading packets until there weren't any more, wasn't any more data to read. So you need a little while loop there. But we'll talk about that in a second when we look at TCP send, because it's the same problem with send. So Google's web page is really quite large, it seems. There's a lot of stuff here. Let's see. Whoops. Yeah, I have two W's, thank you. Yeah, so there's FAST's web page, or at least the first 8K of it. Okay. So that's a web client. Minus the user interface, being able to process images, a bunch of other stuff. But that's the basics. Okay, so here's the whole thing on one slide. just to remind you, we are using MakeSocket with the stream, we use this MakeAdder, and we have this special function, TCPSend. So let's start looking at the library. If there aren't any questions about how to use it, I'm now going to show you how each of these functions work, and at the end of all that, you'll know how to use the sockets library. Okay, so here is MakeAdder. So the rest of the talk is going to be just showing you a lot of code. And then at the end, I'm going to talk about how to use select. Right? So MakeAdder takes a string, which is a host name, a port number, and is supposed to fill up this struct that you've given me a pointer to with an address. Okay? So the first thing we do is we call getHostByName, which just takes a string and returns you information about what IP address and that particular host has, or what set of IP addresses that host has. So for instance, google.com has maybe a dozen IP addresses. And it returns one of these host int things. And the only field of this that we're interested in is this field called HAdder, which contains the actual IP address, which is this four dotted number formatted in one of these little structs. So now I'm going to take this pointer to the sock adder. I'm going to zero out everything in it. That's what the B0 line does. I'm going to set the family of the socket to be AFINET, which just means this is a socket for use on the internet and not for, say, something else, like the Unix sockets protocol. Now I'm going to just set the port number and the address. Okay. So pretty simple, but there's all of these things, these structs around. So you can go and look in the man pages or H files and see what all the structs are, and you'll find that everything is just integers of various sizes or arrays of integers of various sizes. The only thing that's actually interesting about this function, I think, is this thing called htonsport. So syn port is just a 16-bit number, 2 bytes. Port, INPORTT, is also just a 16-bit number. So why am I messing around with it? Why don't I just assign it directly to that value? And the reason has to do with something called network byte ordering. So we're going to talk about that now. So there are two ways that information can be laid out in memory, so-called little endian and big endian. So for instance, if I have a pointer or an address, B0076EFF, and the contents of that address is this number, 65543, a 32-bit value, so that's 4 bytes in memory. There are two possibilities. Well, there's more than two, but we're going to talk about two possibilities about how that information is laid out in memory. Either the pointer points to the smallest or least significant bits, or it points to the most significant bits. So on a big endian machine, the pointer actually points to the byte that contains the most significant bits. And on a little endian machine, it points to the byte that contains the smallest. Okay? So this value, 65543, in binary, looks like this thing on the right. It's a bunch of zeros, a bunch of zeros, a bunch of zeros, one, and then a seven. That's why I have 0017. When you stick it all together, it's 65543. On a little Indian machine, everything would be in memory, the bytes would be organized in memory the other way, because we're pointing at the least significant bit, the little end, rather. So the first byte we have is 7, and the next byte we have is 1, and then we have 2 zeros. Okay? Now notice the bytes themselves are still in the usual order. It's just that the actual bits in the byte are in the same order, but we've swapped the bytes around. So if I have a 32-bit integer on my PowerPC, which I have here on the desk, it's going to look like the thing on the right. And if you have the same integer on your x86 Linux box, it's going to look like the thing on the left. And everything that's sent across the network is assumed to be in this format. So that means if you have an x86 machine, when you get ready to send an integer over the network, you need to switch all the bytes around so that when I receive it on my PowerPC, I can understand it to be the integer that it is and not some other integer. Okay? Right. So I just have to say that this word, little Indian, big Indian, these words actually come from Gulliver's Travels. Has anyone read Gulliver's Travels? No? So there was a battle because the little Indians would break their hard-boiled eggs on the little end, and the big Indians would break their hard-boiled eggs on the big Indian, and this caused a civil war. So even though your x86 machines are not network order machines, the Lilliputians were in fact little Indians, so you can feel good about that. All right, so anyway, we give you some functions for converting between host order and network order. Now, your host order may be the same as the network order, but when you're writing your program, you don't know whether that's the case. You know, if you give the program to me, the host order and the network order are the same on this machine, but on this machine over here, they're not. So anytime you're going to take an integer and send it on the network, you should convert it from host order to network order. And anytime you receive an integer from the network, you should convert it from network order to host order. And there's a lot of functions that are given to you, like HTONL, HTONS, and there are some other ones which convert different sized integers one way or the other. Okay? So anytime you see these HTON or NTOH, it's just flipping bytes around, or possibly doing nothing if the machine you have is already a network order machine. Great. So, enough of that. So you can see that this red stuff is converting between host order and network order. And we didn't have to convert this struct. This struct is really just an int. And that's because getHostByName returns something which is already in network order. So that's the other thing to watch out for, is when you're looking at the man page, getHostByName, it will say, it returns an address in network order. So now you know that thing is okay to send over the network or to give back into the library. But if I want to print it out on the screen, I'm going to have to do something with it to convert it back into host order. Okay? So that's the only way you can really mess up with sockets, is not converting things to or from host order. All right. So moving on. Make socket. Here is how you make a socket. So remember, make socket takes a port number and a family, and it gives you back one of these sockets. So how do you actually do that using the Berkeley API? So we start by creating a socket, calling socket. And all of the sockets that we're dealing with are internet sockets, so I always say AFINET, the family, and this zero is a set of flags. You can provide some various flags when you create the socket. And I'm not providing any here, so that's a zero. Okay. Then if it's a stream socket, I'm setting an option on the socket. And the option I'm setting is telling the system that it's okay to reuse a port number that's already in use. And the reason I'm doing this is because a lot of systems, most systems, when a program that's using a connected socket shuts down, that socket remains active in the kernel for maybe a couple of minutes. So one thing you could do is wait for a couple of minutes for the kernel to finally get rid of that socket, and then you could run your program again, or you can tell the system that it's okay to let me reuse sockets. So if I didn't set this option, then if I closed my program and tried to run it again, it would give me an error saying socket already in use. So that's why I've done this here. Right. So that creates a socket, and then the second thing this function does is bind the socket on my end. And so you bind the socket the same way you connect a socket. You build one of these adder in structures. In this case, the adder in structure has a port number that I want. And this in adder any, this constant says, just give me one of the IP addresses that I have, any one you want, or all of the IP addresses that I have, rather. This line that says sme.sinadder.sadder equals inadder any. So that constant, inadder any, says, just give me my own address, whatever my own address is. Actually, what it says is, I don't care what address I get. And so you'll get one of the addresses that belong to you, or more accurately, all of the addresses that belong to you. And then you call bind. And bind is the thing that actually does the work of binding the socket on your end. So again, we see this idiom where you give a socket, you have a sock adder pointer, and you have to tell the size of the struct. Okay? So that's how you make and bind a socket. Actually, I think it's just the integer zero, but I'm not entirely sure what its actual value is. But yeah, it's an integer of some form. Technically, it's a network order integer which contains, packed into the bytes, the numbers which are the IP address that you want. But in this case, it's zero, which just means go and find whatever my IP address is and use that. It says use the IP address of my machine for this structure, right? Yeah. Okay. All right. So then we had two functions for doing UDP sends and UDP receives. So we'll start with the receive. And doing a UDP receive, you use the function receive from. And when you call receive from, you have to give it a buffer. And you have to give it a maximum size of that buffer. And you can optionally give, well, not optionally, you also have to give a pointer to one of these structs so that it can tell you who the message you received was from. That's what the then parameter is. And it will also tell you how big the structure is that it gave you. So you can see in my little function here, for the purpose of this talk, limits the number of bytes that we receive over UDP to 1K. So if there's more than 1K of stuff in the packet, I'm just going to ignore whatever is left over, and it gets discarded. So that's not a great solution. But actually, UDP packets are limited in size anyway. I think the maximum is actually 4K on most machines. So maybe it's not such a bad choice. So it just calls receive from returns the number of bytes that were received. And so I make sure to put a null terminator and return the result. I actually don't even need to put this null terminator because I'm sure you guys know this, right? Exactly. I used calloc, so everything's zero already, so I could skip that step. Yes, that's one of the things Calloc does, yeah. Okay. So that's receive for simple UDP packets. Send is not any more difficult. You just say, here's a socket, here's a buffer that I want to send, and this is how long it is. And again, you have to give one of these structures that says where you want to send to, and say how big that thing is. And the function is called send to. So for these datagram UDP stuff, we're using receive from and send to. And for regular connected sockets, we have send and receive. That's right. So technically, you can use any of send to, send a message, send, and receive from on any socket. However, the behavior of send to and receive from on a connected socket is not entirely clear, so you probably shouldn't use them. Similarly, the behavior of receive on a datagram socket is a bit strange as well. But all of this is outlined in the man page. For if you man send, then you'll get all the information. All right, so TCP send was a function that I wrote for sending a TCP packet, and let's just look at what that does. So it has some message that it wants to send called message, and it has length C in bytes. So I've just used string len to get the length of this message in bytes. And I'm going to call send, and I'm going to say over the socket sock, send things from the buffer message, and please send C of them. But send might come back and say, I was successful, but I only sent less than some number less than C of them. So I may have asked it to send 100 bytes, and it may have successfully sent 10 and returned. So what I'm doing is I have a while loop here, and each time send is successful, I subtract the number of things it sent from the total length, which is C. And I also increment the pointer for message forward that much. So we go around the loop, and then we try to send again, starting from the place where send left off last time. And then eventually, if we get all the way down to the end and we send all of the bytes, C will become zero, and we'll exit the loop, and we'll have been successful. Okay? So this kind of programming is quite common with the sockets library, because you have these functions like send, which are really implemented in terms of these packets, and the sizes of the packets is unknown to you. So if you try to send a megabyte of data, it's going to get broken up into maybe 4K chunks. And so you're going to have to call send a whole bunch of times to actually send all that information. So the sockets library is pretty much standard on most systems, including Linux. So the sockets library, I think, is part of the standard C library these days. Yeah, so user include has the H files, and if you just run GCC, you'll automatically get the sockets stuff linked in without having to do anything special. Kelly says maybe you have to do L socket. I'm not sure if that's true, but so we could also fix TCP receive with a similar kind of programming. Right? We could receive something, and then we could keep on calling receive until receive didn't receive anything, and then put all that stuff together into a big message. Right? So you can see that we have this receive that we were using before, and it only read size bytes. So we could try calling receive in some kind of loop until it didn't read anything. Is that going to work? So what would happen if we tried to call receive in a loop until it, say, returned zero, that it didn't receive anything. That's right. So receive is what's called a blocking call. So when you call receive, if it doesn't have anything to receive, it waits. So if you were to call receive in a loop, your program probably would never do anything. It would read a bunch of stuff off of the network, and then when it ran out of stuff to read, it would sit and wait for something else to arrive. So that's not a good solution. So there are a couple of ways to try to solve this. One is you can set the socket to be what's called non-blocking. This is one of these options you can set on the socket. And that changes the behavior of receive so that it won't block, but instead, if there's nothing to read, it will return you a special code that says that there's nothing to read. Then you could call receive in a loop until you get this special code. So that would be one way to go, to use a non-blocking socket, as they say. And I'm sure if you Google non-blocking socket, you'll find some code that does that. But I'm going to tell you a slightly more general way to handle this kind of thing using something called select. So I don't remember what's on this slide. So what select does is you give it a set of sockets, or in general, a set of file descriptors, and you say, wait for something to happen on any one of these file descriptors or sockets that I've given you. And when something happens, tell me which ones something happened on, and then I can go and do a send or receive on those sockets, and I'm guaranteed that those functions aren't going to block because you've told me that there's something there, something to do. Right? So if you're writing, say, a web server, and you've got 200 clients connected to you, and you want to wait and see when one of them does something and then respond, this is a nice way to do it because you just say, do a select over this set of 200 sockets, and when any one of them something happens, tell me which one or ones some are ready to go. I'll do stuff with them, and then I'll go back and select again over the whole set. Okay? So that's what select lets you do, and we're going to look at an example of using select sort of to round out the talk. Okay. So notice I said you have to specify a set of sockets. So remember, a socket is just an integer, and we're going to use something called a file descriptor set. And that's because in Unix, a socket is actually a file descriptor, which is just an integer. So an FD set is actually a bit set. So did you talk about bit sets in lecture? Or bit sets, anyone? Did you talk about sets? No? How about linked lists? All right. So a set, as you know, is just a collection of items. Each item is either in the set or not in the set. So you can't have a set that contains 3 and 3. It just contains 3. Right. So a bit set is a special way of implementing a set where essentially you have a sequence of bits, or you have a big array of bits, and you just mark the bits as being 0 or 1 to indicate whether or not the item that corresponds to that bit is in the set. So in the case of integers, this is a nice implementation strategy because if you have a bunch of integers and they're all less than n, you just have an array of n bits and you just mark the bits 0 or 1 to indicate if that integer is supposed to be in the set or not. And that's what an FD set is a bit set for integers. So here's a program that uses the FD sets as implemented by the socket library, or in general by the Unix IO subsystem. So I've declared an FD set called set. I got a pointer to it, just because why not? And then I have a set of macros. And these macros, FD0, FDSet, FDClear, and FDIsSet, are your interface to the set. So FD0 makes the set completely empty, so there's nothing in the set. FDSet adds the integer to the set. And FDClear clears the integer from the set. So what does this program print out? Zero, five. Great. That's what it prints out. Okay? And that's because we started with an empty set, because we called empty 0. We added 0, we removed 2, we added 3, we added 5, and removed 3. So we're just left with 0 and 5. Okay? So that's what an empty set is, and you have to use them in order to interact with select. So that's why I gave you this little example. So select, the signature for select is this. It takes in a maximum number that's included in any of the sets. And that's what this first parameter is. So notice, in this example, I have this number 6 in my for loop. And if I had numbers larger than 6 in the set, I would have to increase that to make sure that I covered the whole set when I was searching through. Right? So that's what this first parameter to select is. It's telling it what is the largest possible number that's in any of the sets that I'm going to be looking through. And then you give it 3 sets, or any of these sets you can give null if you don't care about that set. You give a set of things to watch to see whether or not you can read something off of them, a set of sockets or file descriptors to watch to see whether or not you can write something on them, and a set of descriptors to watch to see whether or not something bad has happened, an exception has been raised on that socket. Okay? And you can also give a timeout value, a maximum amount of time to wait. And then if the timeout occurs, select will just return and there won't be anything in the sets. But maybe that would be good if you're doing the event-driven program like Kelly was showing you. You might select for, you know, a tenth of a second, and then process all those sockets, and then go and take care of your GUI for a little while, and then come back and select for a tenth of a second, and then go and take care of your GUI and switch back and forth. And that might be a way of writing a simple program that's not going to have a lot of data throughput if you do that. All right, so that's select. And now, rather than present to you on slides, I'm actually just going to show you a program that uses select in my editor. I thought that would be easier. So before I do that, I'm just going to run the program so you can see what it does. So the program is called listen. You give it a port number to listen on, in this case 8080, and then you can connect to that program. It will listen for connections, and whatever you send to it, it will just print out on the screen. So there's a program called Netcat, which lets you connect to computers over stream sockets. This is a handy utility to use for testing things, because it will just take whatever you type and send it. So you can see we've detected that we have a connection from, well, our local host. And then I can type stuff, and it will print out here. And you can see it detects that the client is disconnected. I can connect again, and it keeps on listening if I want. I can connect a third time. And this one's still connected. Okay, so that's what this program does, is it sits and waits for connections. And then all the connections it has, it waits for things to be sent on all those connections and prints out whatever gets on the screen. Okay? So it's a little, I don't know, it's a little chat server that only has one half of the chat. Okay. So here's the program. Yes, that's right. Okay, so we get a port number off of the command line arguments, and we're going to create a stream socket, and then we're going to call this function listen. Okay, so remember we had sockets which were bound, and sockets which were bound and connected. Now we have a socket that's bound, it's not connected, but now I've told the system that it's okay for other people to connect themselves, essentially, to the other side of this. That's what listen is doing. So it says, mark this socket as being available. Now I have this I'm going to have this empty set of peers. So this is just a list, rather a set of the sockets that I have connected to different people. And I start out with a zero, and I'm going to add my listening socket into that set. So the listening socket really only has one purpose. It's for you to come to my machine and say, I would like to connect, and then we're going to connect with a new socket, and then that listening socket is going to be freed up for other people to come and say that they would like to connect. So that listening socket is going to be one of the sockets that I'm going to be tracking in my set. So I've added it here, and I'm keeping track of the largest number that's in the set, which in this case, there's only one thing in the set, so that's the largest. Okay? And so here's my program, the main loop. So I'm going to make a copy of this set, because when I call select, it's going to mutate the set. It's going to delete all the things that haven't been, aren't ready for read, and leave the things that are ready for read in the set when it returns. So I want to make a copy of that. And then I call select. I tell it the maximum number that's in the set, and then I want to know all the things that are available for reading of the set that I have. And then I don't care about the other stuff, the writing and the exceptions. And the last null means wait forever. I don't want to time out. Okay? So now select will block and just sit there until something happens on one of those sockets. And when something happens on one of those sockets, or one or more of those sockets, then I need to go and figure out which of the sockets something happened on. So I just go through from zero to max and check each and every number to see whether or not it's set in the read set. If it is set in the read set, that means there's something on that socket that's ready to be processed. And if it's not, it means there isn't, so I can skip over it. Okay? So now we have two cases. One case is that the socket that has things ready to happen on it is my listening socket. So what that means is someone wants to connect to me. So I'm going to accept their connection by calling accept. And that will give me a new socket called new. And I add that to my peers, and I check to see whether it's bigger than my max, and then I keep going. If it's not my listening socket, that means it's one of my already connected peers. So I'm just going to call receive. And note, receive is not going to block, because select has already told me that there's something waiting for me there. So when I call receive, it's going to immediately return with information. And then I do some error checking. And if there's some kind of error, I want to make sure to remove that peer from my list so that I don't try to do anything with them. And then I just print it out. So if you were writing a real server, like a chat server, instead of just printing out here, you might say, send that message off to all your connected peers. And then you'd be like a little chat hub or something. Okay? So all of this code I will put up on the web somewhere where you can get it, and if you have any questions, I'll answer them now or at any time. So, have fun socketing.